This episode is sponsored by Celestron, manufacturer of high-quality telescopes and an industry leader in developing exciting optical products with revolutionary technologies.
I'm Kelly Beatty of Sky and Telescope magazine, and tonight we're going on the tour of the stars and planets that you'll see overhead during May. First, we'll explore this month's quirky lunar phases, track down three planets after sunset and two more before dawn, keep alert for bits of Halley's Comet, and get to know the Swiss Army knife of the night sky. So grab your curiosity and come along with me on this month's Sky Tour. Let's get started with where you'll find the moon during May. Its cycle of phases will be a snap to remember this month, kicked off by a full moon on May 1st. Indigenous American tribes referred to this as the full flower moon because so many flowers burst into bloom this month. The full moon rises just as the sun sets, but as we get a few days deeper into May, moonrise occurs later and later. In late evening on May 3rd, it'll be just 1 degree below the bright star Antares in Scorpius. Now, if you don't see the star right away, just use a fingertip to cover the moon as you look. Last quarter comes on May 9th, and by then the moon doesn't rise until well after midnight, and it sits high in the sky at daybreak. In fact, lots of beginning stargazers are stunned when they discover the moon hanging up in the sky well after sunrise. New moon occurs on May 16th, and a couple of days later it shows up in the evening sky as a lovely, slender crescent that grows a bit fatter with each passing day. We're so used to seeing the moon come and go each month that we sometimes forget how beautiful it really is. First quarter follows on the 23rd, and we're treated to a second full moon on May 31st. Now, you've probably heard that the one on the 31st should be called a blue moon, signifying the second full moon in a month. But did you know that definition is actually an error started by Sky and Telescope back in 1946? Yep. That's when James Hugh Prewitt misread tables of lunar phases in the Maine Farmer's Almanac and came up with the interpretation that's so common today. But he was wrong. That old-timey almanac actually described how, in some years, four full moons occur in a single three-month season, from June's solstice to September's equinox, for example. Anyway, this month you get to witness two full moons on both the 1st and 31st. When the moon's face is fully sunlit, it's easy to make out clusters of dusky, dark markings on the otherwise brilliant lunar disk. Before the invention of the telescope, sky watchers thought the moon was a crystalline orb that showed us a reflected version of Earth. Those dark smudges were thought to be mirrored views of Earth's oceans and seas, and so they were given names like Ocean of Storms and Sea of Tranquility. Today we realize those dark regions really were seas of a sort, vast plains of molten lava that erupted and froze in place billions of years ago. And in a charming nod to history, we still know these features by their fanciful, watery names. Pay attention to where the sun sets or rises, and you'll realize that those points are marching northward along the horizon as the days and weeks go by. That solar slide is due to the changing orientation of Earth's spin axis with respect to the sun as we northerners march through spring and into summer. The sun is also shifting northward for our Australian friends, but for them it means that autumn is gradually becoming winter down in the southern hemisphere. So at this time of year, evening twilight gives way to night later and later. Once it does get dark, look toward west to spot the two brightest planets. Brilliant Venus is hanging low, not far above the horizon. Much higher up is Jupiter. Now let's test your powers of observation. Venus is clearly brighter than Jupiter, but by how much? Twice? 10 times? Well, it's actually about 6 times brighter right now. Astronomers use a unit called magnitude to express an object's brightness, and in this scheme, Venus outshines Jupiter by about 2 magnitudes. Also, you'll see that these two planets get closer and closer during May. They start off spaced about 4 times the width of your clenched fist at arm's length, but by month's end, they're less than 1 fist apart. And as May draws to a close, draw a line from Jupiter to Venus and follow it to the lower right. You just might be able to spot Mercury, which is sneaking into view low down. And make sure to head outside early on the evening of the 18th, when the crescent moon and Venus will pair up dramatically in the western sky. The sun's northward slide along the horizon also means that dawn's twilight comes earlier and earlier. That's too bad, because right now you can track down two more planets in the pre-dawn sky, and you'll need to be outside at least 30 to 45 minutes before sunup to see them. At the beginning of May, look for Saturn close to the eastern horizon. It's not super bright, but no other bright stars are nearby, so spotting it is pretty easy. To Saturn's lower left, by about one fist, is very dim Mars. Now, as the days of May fly by, both of these planets will be higher up during twilight, and that will make them easier to spot. But at the same time, the space between Saturn and Mars gets wider, stretching to more than two fists by month's end. If you find yourself planet hunting before dawn early in May, you might catch one or two shooting stars from the annual Eta Aquariid meteor shower between about 3 and 5 a.m. These are bits of debris shed by none other than Halley's Comet. Unfortunately, the viewing conditions aren't very good when this year's show peaks on the morning of May 6th, because they'll compete with the light of a fat gibbous moon. But watch for them anyway, because the brighter ones sometimes leave behind bright, persistent streaks called trains. Let's pause for a moment for a brief mention of Sky and Telescope magazine, the essential guide to astronomy. Each month's issue is filled with observing tips, deep sky insights, and the latest discoveries. As a subscriber, you'll get unlimited access to thousands of entries on Sky Intel's full website, including decades of archives and observer resources. And you'll get a full year of trusted astronomy content created by knowledgeable editors, astronomers, and passionate sky watchers. Getting all this is easy. Just go to skyandtelescope.org/subscribe. The evening skies of May feature one obvious star pattern that just about everyone knows, the Big Dipper. To find it, all you have to do is look up, way up. You should see the Big Dipper looming over you with its curved handle bent upward and its four-sided bowl apparently overturned as if dumping soup into some imaginary pot. Even though it's so well known, the Big Dipper isn't truly a constellation. It's what astronomers call an asterism, which is simply any group of stars that make a pattern. The Dipper is part of the larger constellation of Ursa Major, the Big Bear. And right now, this woolly beast is on its back, with the stars in the Dipper's handle serving as the bear's tail, the bowl marking its torso, and its head off to the left. Find the two bright stars at the Dipper's left end, which form one side of its bowl. Sky watchers call these the pointer stars, and here's why. Draw an imaginary line through the pointers and follow that line downward by about three fists. You'll come to a moderately bright star. That's Polaris, the North Star. You can use this little trick anytime you want. Just remember that those two stars point to Polaris. The North Star is at the end of the Little Dipper's handle, and, just like its bigger sibling, the Little Dipper has seven stars, with two bright ones marking the outer edge of the bowl, which is jutting toward upper right. Veteran stargazers often use the Little Dipper as a quick gauge of their sky's darkness, because you can only spot all seven of those stars if your sky is mostly free of light pollution. If you have a decently dark night sky, take a look at the celestial real estate between the two dippers. You might be able to trace out a meandering, snake-like trail of stars about five fists long. This is the constellation Draco, the dragon. The end of its tail is halfway between the dippers, and then the body snakes clockwise around the Little Dipper before pivoting sharply toward upper right. The dragon's head is marked by a misshapen, four-sided box about half a fist across. Now don't mistake this polygon for the somewhat larger four-star torso of Hercules, which is a couple of fists farther to the right. And two fists to the lower right of Draco's head is brilliant Vega in the constellation Lyra the Lyre. Polaris is called the North Star because an imaginary line extended outward from Earth's north pole passes very near this star. But it hasn't always been that way. Earth's spin axis wobbles slowly over time, just like the slow, circular nodding of a spinning top or a tabletop gyroscope. This is called precession, and it takes about 25,800 years for Earth to complete that loop. So it's only by coincidence that we're living at a time when Earth's spin axis points northward to Polaris. About 5,000 years ago, when ancient Egyptians aligned their pyramids toward true north, the pole star was Thuban in Draco. Meanwhile, Vega was the north star around 12,000 BC, and will regain that status again in 11,700 years. Let's head back to the Big Dipper, which I call the Swiss Army knife of the night sky, because it helps me find so many other key springtime stars. For example, follow an imaginary line through the pointer stars in the opposite direction from Polaris, and four or five fists later you'll reach Regulus, the brightest star in the constellation Leo. So now you can point to Polaris in one direction, or leap to Leo in the other. But wait, there's more. For starters, follow the curve formed by the Dipper's handle up through overhead until you reach a very bright star about three fists away. That's Arcturus, the spring sky's brightest star, in part because it's rather close to us, a mere 37 light years away. Can you detect this star's pale ginger ale color by eye? Follow that same curved line past Arcturus into the southeastern sky until you come to a rather bright, icy white star, which is named Spica, or Spica in more proper Latin. Congratulations! You now know how to arc to Arcturus and spike to Spica. Look a little toward the lower right of Spica by about one fist for a lopsided trapezoid of four stars that are all about the same medium brightness. It's not far above the southern horizon at nightfall. This is Corvus, the crow, though ancient Babylonians knew it as the raven. In Greek mythology, Corvus is associated with Apollo and Coronis, one of his many lovers. In one version of this story, Coronis had been unfaithful, and Apollo learned about this from a pure white crow. In a fit of rage, he turned the crow's feathers black. Now here's where a little imagination will come in handy. It's not obvious, but the mythical crow is riding on the back of Hydra, often represented as a water snake. Hydra is the largest of all the 88 modern constellations, and what a giant specimen this is. Its head is over in the west, nipping at the paws of Canis Minor, the little dog. Then slide your gaze leftward along the horizon, following its body past Corvus, until you reach the tip of its tail well to the left of due south. That's one giant serpent, 10 clenched fists from one end to the other. And yet, Hydra contains no bright stars at all. So for many of you, it'll have to exist purely in your imagination. But trust me, it's there. That's about it for this month. If you want more tips for viewing the night sky, including a free interactive star chart for any time or date, check out our website, skyandtelescope.org. If you haven't already subscribed, you can find Sky Tour on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. And if you've enjoyed listening to this episode, please leave a rating or a review. It'll help spread the word about Sky Tour, and I really welcome your feedback. And if you want to explore the solar system and universe more deeply, check out the full line of binoculars and telescopes available at Celestron.com. Sky Tour is a production of Sky and Telescope, a division of the American Astronomical Society, and it's produced by me, Kelly Beatty. Next month, we'll try to spot some of the lesser-known constellations in the early summer sky. Until then, I wish you clear skies.